Hey, welcome to Trapital. I'm your host, Dan Runcie. This is your place to gain insights on the business that shapes music, media, and culture. We dive deep into the companies and moguls who start the trends that shape the rest of the business world. There's a lot of buzz right now about touring, specifically about the artists who are doing worldwide and nationwide arena tours and whether they can sell out those seats. You've probably seen some of the headlines. Jennifer Lopez struggled to sell her arena tour. The Black Keys, Troye Sivan, Charlie XCX, and others have been in the headlines as well. But that may not tell the full story because there's other artists like 50 Cent and Pearl Jam and Nicki Minaj and others who have been able to have successful tours in a lot of those same venues. And some of those artists like Nicki Minaj had struggled to do them before but are now having some of the best tours of their careers. So what's really going on? Are these individual instances or is there a broader narrative here to discuss? So in this episode, we're going to break all of that down, and I'm joined by my guy, Akin Alou. He's a touring agent at CAA, and we talk about each level and each step of the touring business right now. What do the incentives look like for the artists, the managers, the fans, the ticketing companies, the events promoters, the agents, and more? To break down what's going on, what this looks like, and some important trends that we can see that can tell us what's coming down the road. This is a really fun conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Let's dive in. All right. Today, we're here to do a deep dive on the concert touring business and where we are right now. We're here to talk about it with Akin Alou from CAA. Welcome back to the pod.
Thanks for having me, man. Always a good time.
This conversation right now about touring is very interesting. And we've seen a lot of success with several artists. We've also seen more tours that have been underselling, haven't been performing well. But what are you seeing on your end?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. If you're hot and you're selling, your tour is sold out at the on sale, the week after. And if you're middle of the road or developing without said heat, it's taking a little bit longer to get there and maybe you're not getting there at all. But I think a lot of it is really about an oversaturation. There's so much stuff on the road. There's been so much stuff on the road. So many must-see tours that anything that doesn't feel urgent is not really grabbing people's attention and people aren't parting with their dollars. There's so many things that are competing for people's time. Bands are having to make choices, right? Do I go see this or see that? Do I even see this or that and instead take my dollar elsewhere, right? Do I go to see a movie? Do I go travel, right? These are all things that are competing for, we're all competing for the same dollar.
Do I even leave the house when I have all these devices at home with all the entertainment?
Do I pay for a movie on Apple, right? Do I watch Netflix, right? All these things are competing for attention.
Looking at some of the tours that have made headlines recently, Black Keys, artists from the band have definitely voiced their frustrations. J-Lo, they tried to rebrand the tour, still didn't work. And this is an artist that had previously sold out arenas. And it wasn't that long ago that she had a very big year with performing at the Super Bowl, an opportunity that few artists get. But meanwhile, Nicki Minaj, who had struggled 5 years ago to go on tour with Future, they couldn't sell an arena tour in North America 5 years ago. And now she had one of the highest grossing hip hop tours that we've seen and the highest grossing one we've seen for a female rap artist. 50 Cent is another one. His Get Rich or Die Tryin' tour did very well. It's tough to have a broad generalization because even though the tours that have captured the headlines for their underperformance, there are others doing very well in this past year.
Yeah, bad news travels a lot faster than good news. And it's probably more fun to hate online than it is to give people their flowers. Nostalgia is back in a very big way. You'll see it with tours like Janet Jackson and Ludacris or T-Pain, right? These are all artists that have captured people's hearts 20 years ago, are tough to see, and they're coming back around now. So there is that urgency to go and see them because you don't know when you're going to see them again. Millennials have a little bit more disposable income now versus 10 years ago when maybe they were in their early 20s. Folks have money to spend and can afford to pay top dollar for some of these shows. That said, again, they're picking and choosing which shows they're actually going to spend that top dollar for. Nicki of it all is interesting too, but she just captured the zeitgeist in this moment, right? I think on that last run, she didn't have anything that maybe made this tour feel like a must-see and this go-around after the album, after some of the back and forth with the Barbie soundtrack, like all of that stuff creates excitement and an added layer of cultural connectivity that makes people, one, talk about the tour and two, want to go see it.
Yeah. And then 50 Cent, too. This is an anniversary. He is commemorating one of the biggest hip hop albums of all time. He's also been one that has continued to break through this current trend that we're seeing.
Yeah, I think he's always also had a demand. And if it wasn't here in North America, overseas, I think his business has always been pretty good. Again, we're seeing it in other genres too, whether it's Green Day commemorating a Dookie, right? Like 50 trying to recapture the power of Get Rich or Die Trying is a moment that everybody who's a hip hop fan remembers. Even if you weren't a hip hop fan, they were definitely waiting for this to come back around. Not to mention, again, when we talk about what sells tours, being culturally relevant, being in the conversation, 50 never really went away. We've got Power and all of the subsequent spinoffs of Power that have kept him in the conversation. I think those things were helpful in driving ticket sales. He's never really stepped away from entertainment, even if he wasn't touring or making music. We still knew his name. And
I do want to talk about this moment that we're in post-pandemic, though, because if you read some of the articles that are coming out, if you read some of the quotes from people in the industry, you do get the impression that there are certain things that have changed. You talked earlier about oversaturation, but are there other factors you think that have influenced this current place that we're in now? Because even though there are still artists that have been successful across genres, there are certain challenges that exist now that didn't exist 5 years ago.
From an artist standpoint, the cost of touring is more expensive, whether it's what you're paying your crew, what you pay for a bus because they're in low supply. All of those things make it more expensive for an artist to tour, thereby also predicating that an artist has to make more money in order to pay some of these expenses down, in order to make touring profitable in the first place. And then on the fan side, there's a handful of things that have changed too. Coming out of COVID, everybody was super excited to be outside. There was pent up demand. There was saved money. You had stimulus checks, so on and so forth. All of these things that gave you additional income, but made you want to feel like you wanted to be part of community. That's subsided a bit. Like now in a place again, where people are going to be a little bit more selective about where they spend their dollars. You've got in the last couple of years, the most stadium tours I think the business has ever seen across the board, right? Whether it was the Weeknd or Beyonce or Taylor Swift, not to mention the multiple arena tours. So all of that stuff, again, is it's causing people to choose. And then the cost of a ticket is going up. So a ticket to the top, to one of the top 100 tours in 2019 was like under $100 on average. And it's now closer to like $125. That's substantial. That's a substantial raise in price. Not to mention the cost of any of the other day-to-day necessities that have also gone up, whether it's gas or groceries or whatever. People are definitely having to choose and decide where they're going to spend their dollars.
So I agree with you on the fan piece of it too, but even when they buy a ticket, what they choose to do on the day of the event, just given everything we've talked about, the optionality there. I do want to talk about the artist piece, and I'll tie in their managers as well. The costs have risen. And because the cost rises, there's more pressure to push for certain guarantees. Part of that can be a financial decision. Part of that can also be an ego thing. But as we both know, there are only certain venue sizes that can guarantee a seven-figure guarantee per show that you put on. And it has to be a bigger venue in order for that to work.
Yeah, that's where in some instances, right, some of the tours that do come down, some of those are a result of guarantee driven decisions, right? Like I need to be making X amount of money in order for us to make this work. In which case I'm only looking at venues of a certain size. And sometimes it doesn't always make sense given what the artist demand is, given who else is on the road, given when we're planning to announce and go on sale, or maybe after everything else is already announced and went on sale, which then less dollars in the marketplace for us to capture because they've been captured by whoever else is already up on sale and potentially out on the road, right? Yeah, the guarantee-driven conversations can be really difficult to navigate and sometimes put artists in a tough position. Or some of what we're seeing in some instances is an adjustment in consumer behavior. Some of these shows do get there down the line, but because fans know they can wait, they know they can pick it cheaper, closer to show days, or maybe even make a decision, a game time decision, because they know tickets are still going to be available. Some of these shows do end up doing 80, 90, 100% business, but don't look that great on the way there. I think you see that a lot in rap. So it's always really tough when you see posts about certain artists struggling when you know that based on past ticket sales patterns, you typically close out strong.
We've often talked about Russ and how people may often seem surprised to see him selling out these larger arenas, but that's someone who has put in work to build this fan base, trained his audience to buy the hard tickets. And it can be very different from someone that may be a big commercial artist from a streaming perspective, but maybe they did more of the festival runs. Maybe they were just doing more clubs. If they end up having the 80, 90% sellout, it may come later on down their line because you may be more likely to get a more casual fan. And casual fan or loyal fan is the same dollar. But that said, you also are putting out a much less secure product into the marketplace because there's just less of a sure thing as opposed to those Russ fans that are like, yes, I am going on this date market in the calendar. But some of these other artists that may stream much more than Russ, their fans may be like, what else is going on today? Maybe I'll make a game time decision.
You touched on two really important things that I like to talk about a lot in this job. And one of them is there's an art to the way that you build to arenas. It really is about leaving tickets on the table, leaving excess demand outside of the venue so that the next time you go on sale, there is an urgency to buy because those people that didn't get in know that they've got to buy sooner in an effort to make sure they get to see the show. There's an art to booking that way that really necessitates that everybody accurately understand what the demand is, right? I think Russ has done a great job at building his touring career. That's the first part. The second part is a real disconnect between how we interpret the data, whether it's streaming or any of that stuff, and what that means in terms of like actual ticket buyers, right? Streaming to me is a very passive activity. So your monthly listeners or even your number of streams doesn't always dictate what you are able to sell hard ticket wise, right? For instance, if you look at Freddie Gibbs on Spotify, he's got maybe 2 or 3 million monthly listeners, but can do 5,000 tickets in a handful of markets around the country. And that's somebody with no radio hit. When we talk about touring, the metrics that people use to determine what's a successful artist on the recorded side isn't one-to-one with what makes a successful artist on the touring side. And that's a whole different skill and part of your business that you have to build intentionally. So when you look at the people that are going into the wrong rooms, sometimes it's a byproduct of not accurately understanding the data.
And this is probably a good time to talk about your role in this as the agent working on behalf of the artist and the manager, because you could potentially be in situations where you may be at odds or see things differently than the artist or manager. We talked about what their incentives are, but you're also coming in from the perspective of, hey, the data may show that you have X amount of streams, X amount of followers, whatever, but that doesn't add up. You just brought up the Freddie Gibbs example. How does that play itself out if you're in a situation where you may be trying to be a bit more conservative and the artist or manager is like, no, I want to do amps. I want to do arena. I want 1.5 mil per show.
I get paid to give my point of view. I've got more information than the manager I'm dealing with in most cases, right? I can walk down the hall and I know what this person is seeing in their genre or with their amp tour or with their arena tour. I have multiple clients within the genre that I can point to and use as examples. So when I'm talking to artists, I'm pulling from that point of view in hopes that I can paint an accurate depiction of what the marketplace looks like. And all I can do is give my advice and my point of view from my vantage point. Do they always take it? Not always. So when I can, I try my best to persuade. That's part of the job. In instances where I cannot, my goal is to figure out how to best protect the downside. So it's like, okay, these are the rooms we have to go into. How can I protect it in an instance where we may not get there, right? Like, can I curtain off certain places? Can I start a small, if you're open to it, and hold upgrades so that we're not starting in the big room and we're falling flat on our face? Can we do multiple? So if you need to do 5,000 tickets in the market, can I start with 2,500 and hold another 2,500 so that if you do the first one, we roll the second one? That's the way I'm thinking. If I can't convince you to do what I think is the right thing, my goal is to then go, how can I protect the downside?
It does make me think of businesses in general where the goal is to estimate some form of demands. I used to work in airlines, and that is a business where they have it down literally to a T. You're trying to fly out on January 27th. You're trying to go from Raleigh to Atlanta. We've been doing this for however many years. We know exactly how to fill that plane and what to price the ticket and how much to oversell based on how many people we expect to not show up. It's literally down to a science. With you all, it's so different because, bring up the Nicki Minaj example again, this is someone that has toured in arenas. This isn't her first time, but it's a very different environment than it was 5 years ago. There's really only so many data points you have of what does a Nicki Minaj tour look like at the United Center.
This is where the job is like part science. It's also a little bit of art, right? You're looking at other comparable artists, You're trying to look at what a song is doing on the charts, where it's going. You're measuring things like, well, how many followers do you have there? Like, there are so many things to pull from. No exact tool available to us yet that I'm aware of, although I'm sure there are tools that exist that are doing a better job at estimating demand, especially since it exists in other industries. Yeah, that's where the job becomes like part art, part science. You're using comps, you're using gut, you're trying to get a sense of how this artist is being talked about culturally. Like, are they relevant? Are they having a moment, right? Like, does a moment even mean from a data standpoint, like determines a moment? Like, there aren't clear numbers, but you know it when you know it.
Let's take a break for our Chartmetric stat of the week. Charlie XCX's tour with Troye Sivan may not have taken off as expected, but that fan base still shows up to stream her music. Her Spotify popularity index is at an 82, which is the highest it's been for her since the stat has been tracked. Let's get back to the episode.
You made me think of two things there. One, the industry is looking at super fan strategies and how to figure out who's going to buy more. And a lot of that has been focused on a recorded music conversation. However, right now, a lot of those super fans are people that buy concert tickets at these prices relative to the people that stream. I have a feeling that the same tools that they're developing for that could also benefit the live industry. That's the first thing. But the second thing, which you talked about, you do have to have some type of pulse, because sometimes there may not be some data point that can tell you that Freddie Gibbs' 3 million Spotify monthly listeners are going to resonate, because you also just get a feel. You're following the culture. You're following music. You know that there's a fan base that, even if they're not trying to drive up his streams, they're going to show up. There's certain intangibles and art-related aspects of it, too, which go into being able to put a package together.
It's tough. You never really know. It's a gut thing. Even with Tommy Richmond, who I work with, like, that's a conversation we're having now. What do we do? Like, what do we think we mean? And it's resonated culturally, but we haven't ever sold a hard ticket in most markets. So, and it comes down to that, like, that feeling, trying to understand and trying to protect downside, right? And having strategies in place where if there is more upside, it's not capped and we're capturing it.
He's an interesting example, because people would love to be in some type of outdoor setting and hear Million Dollar Baby. I literally hear it multiple times a week if I'm walking around. On the other hand, though, most of those people may not know the other songs that he's created, may not even know the other parts of the song beyond just the hook. So how do you make sure that if there is some type of product, there is more? And I know that's where the job does become interesting. But we also know that, especially with artists that are trying to sell at bigger venues, it can take time to be able to get the availability, just considering how long in advance it can take to book these venues. And we should talk about the role of the events promoter with this, because some of the investigative pieces in writing had implied that the events promoters can have their own goals and their objective. They have exclusive licensing where they are either the exclusive operator or sometimes the owner of these particular venues, and they want to make sure that they have artists that are performing in those venues so they can maximize the inventory. And just given the large size venues that they have, which influenced more artists that weren't quite at that amp or arena level to be selling at those.
Sometimes I'll see clips go viral on like Twitter or Instagram where artists or different executives will like really break down the touring game. And I'm like, oh shit, like, it's all out there. And some of them are like tinfoil conspiracies and some of them are like really spot on. But to your point, like, promoters have their own incentives. Live Nation is also a real estate company and that they own a handful of these venues, whether it's venues at that House of Blues level or the amphitheaters where you'll see inventory flow through those rooms. So, and in those rooms where they also own and operate, they're getting a piece of the ancillary business, right? The parking, the concessions, the bar, they're making money off bodies in the room aside from just the cost of a ticket. So they may lose money on the actual promoter deal because they didn't sell enough tickets, but they may actually make money overall when you take into account the cost of all the other revenue that's generated on all the other areas that the artist does not participate in. And that's all upside to that company. So you talk about touring. So there are instances where promoters may try to put shows into certain rooms because it is financially advantageous for them to, and it may not make sense for the artist because either it's too small of a room, sometimes it's too big of a room, right? The package that the artist has put together, the other artists that are going on tour with them, may not dictate that they play the room that they're being put in. But again, if it helps get them to the number that they need, if an artist is saying they need X amount of money and the only way a promoter can get that X amount of dollars by putting them in an amphitheater where they own and operate the venue and they're losing money on the promoter deal, but making money on the ancillary business. That's where it goes. And seat maps will reflect the bad decision-making. Right?
Let's talk about that a bit more. I would imagine that if the events promoter also has a deal where they're owning or operating the venue, they also want to make sure that they're getting enough butts in seats at that particular concert to justify being able to generate revenue from the parking, from the concession, all of the things that you need for people to actually show up. So wouldn't they also take some type of hit if they're booking them at a bigger venue that may be only 66% sold through?
No, because the money that they lose on the promoter side may be less than the money they would make by having those butts in seats. It depends on what your true break-even is, right? There is a break-even on paper for the show itself. But again, like, I don't know the splits or what the incremental revenue is on a parking space that's sold or popcorn that's sold. Like, we don't see those deals from promoters, and only artists at the highest level are able to command that sort of transparency. Very rare that anybody's participating in that or even getting a sense of what the financials are.
It reminds me of Floyd Mayweather and how he would organize his boxing matches where he's getting a cut of every hot dog that's being sold, literally every single transaction.
It's the same business model, right? And he's the 1% in his field, in his sport. He can command that sort of transparency from arenas because he can bring all those people wherever he wants. Like, he is such a draw that no one's going to give up the opportunity to bring him into their rooms. When he's asking for that sorts of deals, they're still making money. He can command it because folks are still getting paid, even with that deal in place.
We should also talk a bit more about the agency role. There are agencies out there that may be taking bigger risks. How do the economics work in that perspective and how that can shape the landscape?
A good question. It does a few things. It manipulates what peers are paid, right? If I'm out there commanding X amount of dollars for someone who's a peer to another artist, if the other artist finds out that X person is getting that, that's raising everybody's price, right? What we're seeing, though, is that some of this talent isn't delivering on the fee that they're asking for, and promoters can get more value out of cheaper artists. So that was the rap that hip hop got for a long time. A lot of the talent was charging exorbitant amounts, and promoters are like, yo, you're bringing me 5,000, 10,000 tickets, but XYZ pop artist, rock artist, indie artist, R&B artist is asking for 50% of that and is bringing the same value. Why am I paying you that? And your show is not even good. It's where you've seen some pullback on rap programming on some of the festivals, in addition to Lushing Out Agenda as well about rap. Business only works if you have repeat customers. So if everybody's not winning, you don't have repeat customers and you therefore don't have a business. So the folks that are out overcharging for their talent, a talent that's out there overcharging promoters for them to perform, we often find that they don't have the same career arc as another artist who's taken the time to build his fan base brick by brick, has charged appropriate fees and delivered on an actual performance. It's other folks who read it like a cash grab who maybe won't have the same longevity from a touring standpoint 10 years from now. But they may be successful recording artists, but as I mentioned earlier, like, those are two different businesses. And they require two different ways of thinking.
It's almost helpful to think about everything as an advance, not an advance in the traditional sense. If you outperform this for each of the business partners associated with your concert, that's going to help you command more, whether that's a slightly higher ticket price or a bigger venue next time around. And it reinforces that with fans, too. If fans feel like you delivered and you exceeded that, at some point, it all becomes an economic thing where, what is the price? Do you exceed the value based on what you offered? And if you did, more will come your way. And if you don't, you're going to have to level expectations at some point. The other thing too that we're talking a bit about, we talked about packaging and being able to put artist groups together, especially if the goal is to have a certain guarantee and sell out a certain size arena. Sometimes the artist may not be able to do it themselves, even if they have a headliner. Who are the artists that you could put together and have these tours? We're currently seeing the Queens of R&B tour, where those artists individually may not be able to do that, but you create this 1+1=3 type of situation. And then now these artists are having a pretty remarkable moment. And I know you've worked on tours where that is the goal. How can we put something together to make it so you're putting something unique out in the marketplace?
Yeah, the goal is the sum greater than its parts, right? Are we putting something together that feels more valuable than it would if everybody was to do their own thing individually? And we're putting tours together. How are we putting ourselves in the fans' minds and point of view and like creating some urgency, right? Anytime I see a tour poster, I like to ask myself, does this feel urgent? Like, do I feel the need to buy this right now? Does this feel like something that people will screenshot and share with their friends or forward or DM on Instagram and say, yo, we got to go see this, right? How can I create those moments that feel culturally relevant, whether it's adding somebody who you haven't seen in a while or putting two people together that you wouldn't think of, or pulling somebody from somewhere else and putting them someplace where you haven't seen them before. Like, and then like, who do artists generally get along with? Because ultimately you can't have people out there on the road with folks they don't get along with. The tour will never work.
Do you think that the popularity of festivals, especially with hip hop and R&B artists, has increased the need or the push for packaging? I think about the posters that we see every time Lovers and Friends come out. Does that type of product being in the marketplace influence how you think more broadly, even though you're not putting a festival together, it's still a live music product that you're trying to sell?
It does, in a sense of like, I'm inspired by that. Like, and the buying habits associated with those sorts of events are the buying habits that you want for your own artist tours. I'm trying to replicate that consumer behavior. I know it's a byproduct of like really exciting, hard to see acts on one bill, or like you're doubling down on a niche, you're giving people an experience, right? Like, I think it influences it from that standpoint. I would also tell you that, like, honestly, some of the curated playlists on the DSPs make me think that way, right? I say to myself, okay, like, I'm in the Pollen playlist. There's folks from across genres on that playlist. Like, if everybody is in this playlist and listening to these artists in one go, like, why aren't any of these groups going out together? Like, how can I bring something like that together? Or like, even if you're online and you're looking at what people talk about in different forums or whatever, like, it's so genreless now that any opportunity I get to bring excitement from other places and like put it in this genre, like, I'm going to borrow from that because I feel like that's what kids are excited about. Like, they're not stuck in any one format or any one genre. They're bouncing around or watching things on the same device, on the same platform. And so my effort is, how do I bring this from this place and bring that from this place and put them all together?
Do you ever find yourself in situations where there may be a push for a newer artist that is bubbling up, getting a lot of media attention, getting a lot of social media buzz, but you have this instinct feeling that this artist may stream, this artist may be a talking point on social media, but I don't think they can sell a ticket? How do you balance that?
It's tough. I had this conversation this morning, actually. Those are ones where I like stand back and like watch and see. Sometimes I'm compelled to get in the fray and figure it out. And other times I don't really see it. There's more than one way to skin a cat. So maybe you can sell a ticket, but maybe you're culturally relevant and can move brands and people want to be attached to you from that point of view. So like, I always think about it from that standpoint. I go back to Tommy because I feel like he's one of those artists that is literally capturing the cultural zeitgeist. And I think the difference there is like, he has catalog. He's been doing it for a lot longer than people think. Anytime that the idea of him being a plant is raised, there's people who come to his defense, and not just like one or two fans, but like multiple account and individuals who defend it. I've heard the new music. I've got real associations and ties to other established artists who co-signed it. So like, I think when I'm trying to figure out the difference between the two, right, it comes down to like, what's the catalog? What's the work ethic? What is that artist about? Who are they? Is it real? Have I sat down with them? Can I tell it's real even from looking at my phone? Those are things that I pay attention to. So
I'll never understand the industry plant talk with anyone, because especially the way things are right now, if the industry had the power to just pluck someone in and make them a star, they would do it. Those days are gone. A lot of that is out of anyone's control right now. I think sometimes people just use the term industry plant when there's something that blew up and they see it everywhere, and it's not someone that they may particularly opt in to listen to.
Yeah, it goes back to our earlier conversation. It's like, it's a lot easier to hate on something than it is to like give people flowers online. And the hate goes way more viral.
Agreed. Before we close things out, let's end this on a positive note, because we've talked about artists like 50 Cent and Nicki Minaj, who were able to go up a level with their most recent tours. Who's another artist that you can think of that maybe they have something in the works, maybe they haven't announced any tour right now, but you have a feeling that if this artist was to say, hey, I'm coming out, I'm putting out a tour, I'm going to go do arenas, you think that they would do pretty well?
That's a good question. So here's what I'll say. I think Brandy, when she's ready to come back, would be massive. I feel like she has so many younger artists out there that she's inspired, that are influenced by her. She's always managed to flirt with cultural relevancy. A brother obviously is like culturally relevant in his own right. I could see a world where she comes back. I could see that tour, the prize, package, rooms. I could see it doing real damage.
We need that Norwood tour, Ray J and Brandy.
Absolutely. I'm the first one there.
Something tells me that she probably wouldn't agree to that, but you never know. But Akeen, appreciate you. This is a lot of fun. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, man. Always a good time. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoy this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to one or two people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, rate the podcast on Spotify, rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.